stories that lead up is Jesus Christ's preparation of his people to exhibit resurrection faith until that faith becomes what? Sight. Because we believe that it is going to become sight. But in order to be faith, they had to express it before his death, burial, and resurrection. We express it after, obviously, his death, burial, and resurrection. But Jesus demonstrates his divine power while leaving room for the ultimate expression of faith in resurrection. Certainly that for the people that were there present with him, true for us as well. And he demonstrates this power by raising Lazarus from the dead. But it will still require faith to believe that Jesus is going to do this himself. However, there was and is context for believing Jesus' words that he would indeed rise again. And so what we want to say this morning is this. Jesus builds our faith by proving life-saving power. Jesus proves and builds our faith by proving life-saving power. So you might be asked, well, what can a God with life-saving power do? Well, the better question is, what can't a God with life-saving power do? You see, belief in his life-saving power strengthens our faith in three areas that we're going to look at this morning. Supporting our resolve to trust what he says. Now, there was a conclusion for these people that were there at Lazarus' time. They got to see Lazarus rise from the dead. And in just a few short days or weeks, they got to see Jesus rise from the dead. They got to see him afterwards. Their faith became sight. Friends, for us, it is still faith. Unless you've seen personally the risen Christ, which would be amazing. I'd like to know about that. As far as I know, though, nobody in this room has, in a physical way, put your hands in his side and touched his wounds as Thomas did. And so for us, it is still an issue of faith. First thing is this, though, if you're following along in your notes, is that faith in the purpose of Christ. What we're going to read today is going to bolster or strengthen our faith in the purpose of Christ. If you have a Bible, we are in John 11, starting in verse 3. Therefore, they sent the brothers to him, saying, Lord, behold, the one whom you love is sick. And Jesus heard and said, this one is not sick to the point of death, but that the glory of God and that the Son of God may be glorified through him. And Jesus loved Martha, her sister, and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he remained in the place he was staying for 2 days. Then after that, he said to the disciples, let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews desire to stone you now, and again you want to go there? Jesus answered, is there not 12 hours in a day? If anyone walks around in the day, he will not stumble because he sees the light of the world. But if anyone walks around in the night, he will stumble because the light is not in him. After saying these things, he said to them, Lazarus, our friend, has fallen asleep. But I will go in order that I may wake him up. Then the disciples said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will get well. But Jesus said this concerning his death. But they thought it was concerning his sleep of which he spoke. So then Jesus said to them plainly, Lazarus died. And I rejoice for you in order that you may believe. For we are not there, but we must go to him. So in this section of scripture, Jesus appears to brush off what is a very serious situation. It's a life and death kind of an issue. But he does share in it the purpose of Lazarus' affliction, namely that it's for the glory of God, that the Son of Man may be glorified through him. And if you were here last week, we saw a similar kind of situation with the man born blind. The disciples, upon coming upon this blind man, said, hey, Jesus, who sinned, he or his parents, to make him blind? And Jesus said, no, it's not about sin here. It's so that you may see my glory, so that you may grow in your faith. So here we see Jesus saying that Lazarus' condition will lead to the glory of Jesus. How so? Well, we're going to see momentarily. That's coming soon. But Jesus is setting up a state of affairs in which he will be able to demonstrate his power with an end to bolstering the faith of his followers. And not just the disciples, not just Mary and Martha and Lazarus and the family and the friends, but for us too. That said, upon hearing the news of Lazarus' condition, Jesus promptly waits 2 days. Wait a minute, did I read that right? What is our initial response to sickness? One of our friends or family, well, we go to them, right? If they were in the hospital, well, let's go see them. Let's go pray with them. Let's go support them. Let's let them know we love them. Let's bring flowers and a card. And Jesus said, oh, I'm not, we'll wait a couple of days. Clearly, to some that were observing, this also was an odd thing to their mind. You might ask, have the purposes of God then made him callous to the condition of those who loved him and followed him? Obviously not. You see, John offers some commentary that Jesus did indeed love Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. He plugs that right in there. It's kind of a funny sentence. It's almost like it doesn't fit. But John wants you to know, hey, look, guys, Jesus, he does love them, okay? He's got a plan here. He has a greater purpose. So after 2 days, Jesus announces that he and the disciples will return to Judea. Now, we have to know, it's late in the public ministry of Jesus Christ. People are on to him. The religious leaders are upset with him. And going back into Judea actually presents a problem. It's actually dangerous, potentially dangerous, for Jesus and his disciples to go back there because people have been planning on how to kill him. And so the disciples say, you sure you want to do that? I mean, you know, Lazarus is not doing well, but do we want to go into Judea? Perhaps his disciples thought he delayed because of the danger and he didn't want to go. Problem is, it just wasn't the right time. So Jesus responds with an analogy, drawing again on the theme of light and darkness, day and night, that he's been drawing on throughout John. There's a short window of time in which the work of Christ can take place. That is, the time in which the light of the world is in the world. During this time, there is safety and light so that the works of God may be accomplished without the interference of darkness. And to relay this truth, Jesus gives an illustration. This is what he says. Is there not 12 hours in a day? If anybody walks around during the day, he won't stumble because he sees the light of the world. But if anyone walks around in the night, he will stumble because the light is not in him. So we used an illustration to point this out. If you've ever been lazy and tried to walk through a room without taking the time to flip on the light switch, you take your life in your hands. You may think you know where the furniture is in that room, but your toe or some other part of your body will inevitably find the toy, the Lego, the leg of furniture, something, right? But if it's light, we can see where we're going. We see the obstacles. We avoid them. And Jesus says, generally, there are roughly 12 hours of light in a 24-hour day. This is the time you do the walking around. This is the time you have activity. And you will be successful in those things because you can see the threats, the dangers, the challenges, and you can adjust. And those things don't throw you off. They don't stop you from what you're doing. However, if you tried to accomplish the same things at night, you will be largely unsuccessful because you can't see the threats, the dangers, and the challenges. And it's likely that what you're trying to get done, you at the very least will not be able to do with the same degree of efficiency. And so after giving this kind of the short parabolic kind of a statement, Jesus clarifies, kind of. He says, Lazarus has fallen asleep, and they need to go wake him up. The disciples respond, well, he doesn't need us to wake him up. I mean, if he's sleeping, he's going to get better. He's going to wake up. He's going to be fine, Jesus, if that's all that's going on. And so then John, the author of this book, intervenes again with some commentary to let us know what's going on, clarifying that Jesus referred to Lazarus' death. That's what he's talking about. He's speaking analogically. He's using an illustration. But why does Jesus speak figuratively about this at first? Perhaps he's referring to the ease with which he can exercise resurrection power. He just sleeps. For me, it's like he's sleeping. I'll just wake him up. You see, we image bearers can't do anything about death on our own. But for God, resurrection is as simple or as easy as waking someone up. And so for Jesus, there was not really an emergency. Didn't matter if he got to him in time or not, his resurrection power was sufficient. But then Jesus levels with them. He steps out of speaking parabolically, and he says, Lazarus is dead. He is indeed, he's gone, and we need to go to him. But this is cause for their rejoicing, Jesus says, because they're about to see something that will grow their faith and that will glorify God. But they all need to be there to see it. They've got to go to him. Make no mistake, God could have healed Lazarus from here, but they needed to go there. He could have brought him life from right here, but in order for the belief of all involved, they needed to go there to where he was. See, God wasn't in the wrong place. God isn't early, isn't late. He's precisely where he chooses to be. And because he's God, that's precisely where he should be. See, our sense of timing is only correct in as much as it aligns with his sense of timing. We want things to happen now. We have this great sense of instant gratification in our culture. And as much as we like talk about it being bad, as much as we preach about it and teach about it being bad, it's kind of ingrained in us. We've got an internal clock for when God says yes or no to a prayer request, don't we? Well, if he said yes, I mean, it would have happened, 24 hours ago. Clearly, it's a no, right? If I should keep praying about that. And not only do we want them to happen like now or yesterday, we want them to happen in a certain way. And our way is the best way for those things to happen. Our expectations about the way things should work. Now, that's the best way things should work. But God does not move in the place, the time, or the way that we think he should. And if we begin to think that way, we catch that, we got to hit pause. You just stop. When we realize that we are projecting our expectations on how and when and where God should work. And we should ask the question, what does God want to show us that we're missing? I've been praying for the salvation of some of my family members since I was a child. They haven't received Christ yet. Did God not answer my prayer? Does he not hear me? What does God intend in this situation? What is he trying to teach me? What is he trying to show me? Is there a display of his power, a display of his faithfulness or love that our plans, our ideas about what's right would blind us to? What if he just did things our way? What would we miss? Sounds like a lot, potentially. So when we open ourselves to the purposes and the plans of God, and we exercise faith in his goodness, and that it will result in our best, we're on the right road. Friends, I think there were likely times where we were impatient for each other. And what I'm talking about now is the last few years of our life, the last few years of the life of Christ Life Church. You searched for a pastor. You went through a process. It was sometimes very difficult. I'm sure it's sometimes people were like, God, please just let's wrap this up, okay? This is hard. We, on the other side of the country, were praying for a ministry in which we could glorify God with the gifts that he's given us and have a great spiritual family. And we wanted it to be a little bit warmer and sunnier too. But that couldn't come quick enough for us. We're like, all right, God, anytime you want to do this, I don't know how you're going to do it, but man, yesterday would have been great. And at times we were frustrated, at times we were impatient, at sometimes we doubted whether God was ever going to fulfill these desires that we had in our hearts. But in the right time we did, and we're looking at almost a year from when we came and visited and interviewed here, and time just flies. And we look back on that and we go, man, it seems like we've just been here forever. But God was doing something in all of our lives in this room during that time. He was preparing Christ's life in some very significant ways. He was growing you. He was teaching you. He was building your faith. Friends, in Washington State, he was doing the same thing for us. He was growing us. He was teaching us. He was humbling us. He was building up a love for you in us, even though we didn't know who the right recipient of that love was going to be. And if he had brought us together sooner, we may not have recognized it. We may not have even liked each other. I tell my wife, if you had been around me when I was in junior high and high school, man, I don't know if we'd be married. You know, it was a good thing that we kind of got connected out of that season of my life. But God is doing good things, and his timing is good, and sometimes it's hard when we're in the midst of that waiting season to feel like anything good is going to happen. But even there, he is teaching us, he is growing us. Church, he was preparing all of us so in his time, there would be no denying his hand on things. There would be no denying that he was here and that he worked this out. And if you were to ask anybody that was involved in that process, they could speak to how God was at work. Not just in their lives, but in our lives. Talk to a search committee member. It's a good story. We'll tell it someday. This is why we wait on God, isn't it? Lots of examples of that in the Old Testament. God said, wait on me. There was dangerous situations. Armies were gathering. God said, wait on me. And so we still wait on God. And so we trust the purposes of God. Next thing, we have to have faith in the promise of God, or the promise of Christ. Faith in the promise of Christ. And so we pick up our story in verse 20. John continues to write, when Martha heard that Jesus had come, she went out to him. But Mary stayed in the house. Then Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you were here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that whatever you ask of God, God will grant you. Jesus said to them, he will raise your brother. Martha said to him, I know that he will raise him up in the resurrection in the last day. But Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he will die, he will live. And everyone living and believing in me will not die. Do you believe this, Martha? And she said to him, yes, Lord. I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. And she said this and went and called Mary, her sister, saying privately, the teacher is here. He is called for you. And when she heard, she got up quickly and came to him. But Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where he met Martha. Then the Jews were with her in the house, consoling her, seeing that Mary quickly stood and went out, followed her, thinking that she went to the tomb in order to weep there. Then when Mary came to where Jesus was and seeing him, fell down at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you were here, my brother would not have died. Martha goes. Mary stays initially. Meeting him, Martha expresses her grief. She also expresses her hope. If you were there, Jesus, this wouldn't have happened. If you had come 2 days ago, this would not have happened. He wouldn't be in that tomb. He would be well. He'd be talking with us, eating with us, enjoying your company. But even so, I know you can do something about it now. I know the story's not done. The final chapter's not written. And Jesus answers immediately. He doesn't leave her in suspense. He answers right away that her request will be granted. And Martha affirms her faith. She believes in the eventual resurrection from the dead. It will happen. Yes, Jesus, I believe that you are Christ. I believe that you are Messiah, that you've come to do this. But Jesus now takes the opportunity to point beyond the here and now to the eternal truth of resurrection, beyond that time, that situation, and that place. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he will die, he will live. And everyone living and everyone believing in me will not die. This is what's called an I am statement. There are seven I am statements in the book of John. It is a claim to deity. When Jesus says, I am, in this context, he's not just saying, me. He's saying, I am God. I am the resurrection and the life. Nobody can claim that if you're not God. If you do, you're crazy or you're a liar, right? So the hope of resurrection and the source of life is in his presence. And anyone who believes that this is the case, though physical death will come as it does for all of us, still he will live, still he will persist in life until the resurrection comes. And everyone who is living in him and believing in him will not die in finality, that is, be eternally separated from God, but will be with him, with a resurrected body, and an opportunity to know as we are known. Do you believe this? He asks. To which Martha responds, confirming his title is Christ and his nature is the Son of God. And then she runs away to get Mary. The point of this little exchange is that physical death is never the end for the believer. That's the promise of Jesus Christ. That's the hope that we all have. It's the hope that the apostles talked about when they wrote to the church. This hope we have that we won't, even though our body dies and is buried, we won't die in the sense that we will never be separated from our God because we believed in him. Beyond this, Jesus isn't just the God of now, he's the God of our future. So many times we question the promises of God when he doesn't act in the ways that we anticipate. For some of us, things are pretty rough right now. For some of us, we don't really know what's going on with our career, with our marriage, with our kids, with our financial situation. We may not even know what's going on with our walk with God right now. Perhaps there is confusion and doubt there. But the bottom line is this: God is on the throne. Do you believe this? Jesus says. Or is he only on the throne? Is he only the I am if things happen the way that I think that they should, in the time I think they should, in the place that I think they should? If that's the case, it sounds kind of like we're the one on the throne, doesn't it? Sounds like we're the one sitting there going, okay, God, here's the plan, okay? Now, I'll let you talk in just a minute. Shh. But let me just lay this out first, okay? And then I'm just going to get your signature down on the bottom. Make sure you approve of that, and we're good to go. And so we don't come to God with a blank slate. We don't give him the sheet of our lives and say, God, what do you want? What would be good for me? I want that. I trust you. I know you are love. I know you are good and faithful and powerful and true. And so we give that. We go, oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. Okay. There's been some things I've seen in my life that lead me to believe, God, that perhaps I have a better idea of how this should go. And so you can see the sheet, you can put your little name on it, but I'm gonna put some things down first. I'm gonna lay out some restrictions, some guidelines for you to follow so that I can be good with it. Okay? And we do that, don't we? And we even think it's kind of holy and wise, you know, for us to do that. But really what's going on is we've said, Jesus, I'm not really comfortable with you sitting up there right now. I'm going to need you to come down here, have a seat. I'm going to take a spot on that throne. I'm going to direct things for a bit. I've got this. At least that way I know that I'm safe, right? Friends, that is the most dangerous place you could be. Is trying to dictate to a holy, powerful, all-wise God the best idea for how things should play out in your life. You see, Jesus is Lord then only as long as we agree with things. Friends, believing in the promises of God requires us to get off the throne and to coronate him as Lord. not coronate ourselves. We got to take that crown off. We need to get down off of that throne and stop dictating the circumstances of our life need to be a certain way, or we're not happy. We're not going to obey anymore. God doesn't do what we want. But now, Mary comes to him, and she falls at his feet. Her position as a learner and as a worshiper of God, this isn't the first time Mary's fallen at his feet. And she expresses the same sentiment as her sister. Now, Lord, if you were here, my brother would not have died. You see, when Martha said this, Jesus reminded her of the promise of God. But for Mary, Jesus responds differently. Instead of a verbal response, now we see emotion. We see action. Ultimately, both expressed faith in the person of Christ. Faith in the person of Christ. So we pick up our story again in verse 33. Then when Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews coming together also weeping, he was deeply moved and troubled in his spirit and said, "Where did you lay him?" They said, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some among them said, "Could not he who was able to open the eyes of the blind act so that he may not die?" So like, yeah, we don't do that too. Then Jesus answered, because he was again deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone was laid against it. Jesus said, "Roll away the stone." Martha, the sister of the one having died, said to him, "Lord, there is already an odor. It's already the fourth day." Jesus said to her, "Did I not say that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" Then they lifted the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I give thanks to you for hearing me. And I know that you hear me at all times, but on behalf of the crowd standing around, I speak, in order that they may believe that you sent me." And these things he said, and in a great voice cried out, "Lazarus, come out." And he came, the one having died, having been bound by his feet and hands with cloths, and his face having been wrapped with a face cloth. And Jesus said to them, "Untie him and release him to go." Well, these verses serve as an antidote to any callousness we might have perceived in Jesus, don't they? Jesus sees Mary's grief and he grieves with her. The Son of God, the second person of the Trinity, grieves with his creation. And so we must not quickly move past the humanity of Christ as he grieves the consequences of death that sin has brought into his perfect creation. He wept. He was deeply moved. Now, we freely admit, it's not that he was taken by surprise, but we and he are allowed to feel the feelings and the reality of the moment. We are to grieve, feel gravity. See, Jesus didn't diminish feelings just because he was God. We're called to grieve with those who grieve. And Jesus Christ was our perfect example. And so what did he do? He stopped. He felt that moment with his dear sister. He grieved with them. He wept. You see, in these moments, we do see the person, the Son of God. We see Jesus. He is not distant from his creation. And it's hard to feel sometimes. Sometimes we feel like he is distant if he doesn't do what we want in the time frame we think he should. But he's not. He's a God who weeps with us. He's a God who feels what we feel. Hebrews says we do not have a high priest who is unsympathetic and unfamiliar with the things that we face. He knows them very well. But some there still maintain that if he could give sight, as they already clearly knew about, could he not also then prevent this death of Lazarus, his friend? But prevention wasn't the point. Persuasion was. If Jesus had just rolled in and healed a sickness, it would have not had the same effect at raising a dead man from a tomb after 4 days. And so he draws near to Lazarus, and he commands that those present participate in the work by rolling away the stone. Then there's a brief break in the action, and Martha very practically expresses doubt. What about the smell? He's been in there 4 days. Well, this is all part of the plan, as Jesus reminds her. And Jesus said to her, "Did I not say that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" Responding to Martha, and then the action resumes. Then they lifted the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I give thanks to you for hearing me, and I know that you hear me at all times, but on behalf of the crowd standing here, I speak in order that they may believe that you sent me." And these things he said in a great voice and cried out, "Lazarus, come out." This miracle was done so that those watching would recognize the glory, the deity of the Son, so that they would believe in his power, so that they would receive his message, so that they would realize that there was hope and salvation for the future, so that they would realize there's a resurrection. It's not all here. There's a future for me. So they lifted up the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes. Man did what they could do, and now Jesus does what only he can do. He raises his eyes to heaven, and he calls on the Father, giving thanks in advance for a great miracle that's going to happen. You see, he knows the Father is always listening, but in this circumstance, he clarifies for those that are there that it is for their benefit that he now speaks. You ever prayed with one of your kids so they could hear it? Maybe it was not the kind of prayer that you would normally pray if you were just praying by yourself, but you pray with your child, and perhaps it's a little simpler so that they can understand and they can grasp and they can begin to see mom or dad praying. And so here Jesus slows things down a little bit, and he prays for the benefit of those he loves right there. He is God, and he demonstrates the power of this connection in order that those there would come to belief. And so with the approval, with the empowerment of the Father, Jesus now speaks to sleeping Lazarus, calling him out of the now open tomb. And again, Jesus calls those present to participate in the work of removing grave preparations that had bound Lazarus' body. So here's the scene. Jesus prays out loud in the presence of these people to his Father. He calls Lazarus out. Lazarus comes stumbling out somehow, fully wrapped. That must have been quite a sight. And Jesus said, "Unwrap him." This is an interesting thing. Some days, perhaps weeks later, Jesus' tomb is found empty. Do you remember what they found inside the tomb? Laying there, neatly folded. It's a little bit different, isn't it? Jesus is the Son of God, uncreated. Lazarus is created. So there's some differences in this resurrection. But do you see how the Son of God is building faith and expectation for what he can do? You see, it was Jesus' conversation and connection with the Father, which was to prove his deity as the Son of God, and from this impress upon them the validity of his message and inspire faith in his ability to do what he said and accomplish his mission on earth. And all of this was to inspire faith, not an irrational leap, but an in-person demonstration of the Son of God. And this is where we get off. Sometimes we think of a leap of faith, we say. A leap of faith. It's not going to make sense to me. I'm going to do it anyway. And I would never talk somebody out of doing something God called them to do, whether they could articulate the reasons or not. But friends, we've got to stop thinking of faith as counter to rationality. It's not nonsensical. It may not make sense to us, but it makes perfect sense to God. And if we trust Him, if we're following Him, we will be able to express that faith. Faith in what? That He is who He says He is. That He can do what He said He can do. For some of us, it's really difficult to trust. It's really difficult to exercise faith because people have let us down. They've lied to us. They've broken promises. They've hurt us. And even though we don't mean to, we begin to project some of that doubt and that pain onto God. And we say, yeah, I've heard really big fancy promises before. People have said they loved me before. People have said they would stay with me before. People said they would do things for me before. People have said they would help. And when I needed it, they weren't there. But for the Son of God, it is impossible for Him to overpromise and underdeliver. And that's what He's doing right now in this story, showing us that, hey, I can do what I said I can do, and I will do what I said I will do. Worship team, you can come on up. Friends, our faith in Christ will someday become sight, but in the meantime, Jesus builds our faith by proving His life-saving power. Jesus went to great lengths to strengthen our faith. And through His acts on earth, He sought to build our faith in His purpose, His power, and His person. But now some of you might say, look, I don't have a problem believing in Jesus Christ for my eternity. I don't have a problem in believing that I'll have a resurrected body one day. I believe that Jesus is the Son of God. I believe He has the power to do anything. It's right now that I've got a problem. It's right now that my faith is being tested. I don't see a purpose in my pain and in my confusion and in my suffering and in my doubt. See, my doubts don't have anything to do with eternity. They have to do with right now. My job, my marriage, my kids, my friends, my finances, my faith. That's where I got challenges. I need to see Him, but I don't. It's like He's waiting to show up in all these areas. He's aware of the alarm, but He's just going to wait a couple of days. Friends, remember, it is not God's absence. It is God's timing that's at stake. He's good. He is love. It's for our best and for Him to display Himself in the most powerful way to grow our belief. What can a God with life-saving power do? What can't a God with life-saving power do? Friends, if He can raise the dead, He can raise your marriage. If He can raise the dead, your finances are not a big deal. If He can raise the dead, nothing that challenges you right now is a problem for Him. And perhaps He's bringing you to a point where you acknowledge that. God, I don't have it. I've been on the throne, and I'm trying to rule, and guess what? It doesn't work. So I need to step down. What did I just do? Your faith just became sight. It was small, right? There was some tension in there because I had to get through a message. And you wondered the whole time. You couldn't focus because you wondered, does a $2 bill even exist? Friends, it's just a matter of time. In the past, He's shown Himself powerful and faithful in your life. He's shown that He loves you. He's shown that He'll provide. He's shown that He's good. And right now, maybe He's saying, instead of freaking out, instead of being anxious, I just want you to remember how in the past I showed myself faithful, how in the past I grew your faith and prepared you for this challenge that you're in right now. Don't receive it as my absence. Receive it as my love and an opportunity to grow in faith and the grace and knowledge of Christ. And so now we need to, instead of growing fearful, anticipate how he is going to show himself in our present and in our future. And as he proves himself again and again, your faith will become sight when we stand face to face with him. Let's pray. Well, Father, you're good. You have shown yourself powerful, faithful, loving, and worthy. And God, some of us are in a rough spot right now because you are challenging us, you're testing us. You're not doing it so that we will walk away. You're doing it so that we will press in, so that we will exercise faith based upon what you've already shown us. So God, I want to ask right now that you would encourage our hearts, that you would give us everything that we need. If our faith is weak, God, strengthen it. If we're discouraged, I want to pray for your encouragement in the lives of these people. God, help us to recall times where you showed up and it was powerful, and there was no question that your hands were all over it. God, some of us need your encouragement right now. Some of us need to sense your presence and your love. And so I'm going to ask for that. That if somebody here feels alone, feels abandoned, feels like they're facing a challenge and they don't know what to do or say or even how to think about it, that your presence would be something that they can sense, and that you would minister powerfully to them this morning.